Welcome back to Iambic Podcast. I am your host, Sharon Smith, and I am with the author, director, comic, burlesque dancer, poet, podcaster, blogger, cook, freelance writer. Did I get any more stuff you're going to do, Miss Jill of all trades?
Bomb-ass pussy.
Okay, there you go. Auntie Vice. Yay! Hey,
thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah, most definitely. Most definitely, Jill of all trades. Go ahead. just random. I was starting to lose places. I was like, oh, I'm going to make a paragraph out of all the stuff you do.
I do things.
You do things. But no, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And so this show is basically because you are going to be featuring January 6th at Monday Poetry Reading over at Sacramento Poetry Center.
Yes, I will be.
You're going to be feeling, you feel excited about that?
I am. It's been a minute since I've been on stage in that manner, so yep. I'm looking forward to it. I even have new stuff to read and perform.
You have new stuff? There's new material exclusive. But being that you are, you basically looking at all the stuff you got, author, freelance writer, comic, poet, blogger. I mean, you just like writing.
I love writing.
You really like writing. But what brought you in to do poetry along with your writing?
So I hated writing for a very long time. Mm. I was very bad at writing all the way through grad school. I was an abysmal writer. And then I worked in policy and the political realm for a while, wrote as an academic, wrote as a policy writer, which is a very specific kind of writing. And there's jargon with it. It's very formal. It's footnoted. And so when I started to write for a more general audience, I needed a way to transform my writing to reach people in a different way. And poetry requires you be very precise, you be aware of form, you choose your words very carefully.
Uh-huh.
And I liked it for that. It helped me restructure my writing. The same reason I started doing stand-up is because so much of what I did to that point, there wasn't immediate feedback. There was a lag of anywhere from 6 months to 5 years before I'd get feedback on a project. And being on stage as a stand-up, you get immediate feedback. You know what registers with an audience. You know what doesn't hit with an audience. And so between the comedy and the stand-up, it helped me reshape my writing in a way that made me a better writer for a more general audience.
Being that there is comic writers and then there's stand-up comics, just like there are poets that just write in books, and then there's actually performing poets, we call it page or the stage. Mm-hmm. Do you feel more comfortable on page or the stage or both?
The page. I much prefer, right? While I'm not uncomfortable on the stage, like I don't have stage fright or anything, none mm-hmm. of that bothers me.
Being that you're a burlesque dancer.
Yeah, I've always been comfortable in front of an audience, but I feel I have more range mm-hmm. when I'm on the page. I can do a lot more interesting things.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, when you're writing for an audience for a performance, it's one type of writing. Writing for page, I've done everything from erotic novels, you know, the ones you see in the drugstore with Fabio on the cover. From that to academic writing to futuristic fantasy writing. And I like the range I have on the page better.
Oh, okay. Okay. So let's bring it back to poetry for a second. So what is your favorite poem? Do you have a favorite poem that you like, that you've written or someone else has written?
My favorite short one is by Langston Hughes, and it's called Monday Morning.
Okay.
And it's, here I sit, my shoes mismated, Lottie Mercy eyes frustrated. And I think it so captures a Monday. I think it's just perfect. I love a lot of his writing. Quite, you know, he's spectacular. I like Rumi, the poet. You know, I like a range of poetry. Walt Whitman, I really enjoy. In terms of stuff that I've written, the one that you inspired, Confession, I love it because everybody That's one that registers with people.
Oh, okay.
And it makes them laugh. I get to play around with a lot of simile and metaphor, and basically I appropriate all the religious iconography and turn it into a sex poem, and I love that.
Oh, okay. Seeing that a lot of your poems, well, a few of your poems are very comical. Mm-hmm. I was looking at that being, does that also, do you get most of that from your comedy stint that you were doing, or is just some stuff that you just comes out of your mind? And
I have a thing with the way poetry, a lot of the poetry that's resonating now is gone. It's very much around social justice, body awareness, which is great. Everybody needs to find that part of them. It also feels very, I'm an English major in college, and these are the different classes I do, and these are the poems I write for it. It's like, it doesn't resonate with me. And there's so much sadness, and it really, the way it's gone in a lot of poetry venues is the more damaged, the more you expose your brokenness, the more you expose your pain, the more people resonate with you. And so people begin to think that their pain and their trauma is where their value's at.
Oh, okay.
And they keep telling these stories of their pain and their trauma and never resolving it. And it bothers me because so much of, like, we all have trauma, we all have broken places, but we also all have joy, and that's really been left out of so much of the poetry that I've seen performed and so much of what is resonating with people. So I go, you can address things that are difficult and still bring up the joy in them and still, or poke out the ridiculousness of it. And so for me, it's finding the truth in it, but bringing back some of that joy, because that's the part I want to resonate with. I don't want to sit in my brokenness and my pain. That's not where I want to live. I want to live in my joy. So when I perform, I'm going to perform that. It's almost a protest to all of this. I hate my body. The world hates me. I've been raped 12 times. My parents disowned me. And I'm like, yeah, it's my standard joke when I do a poetry show is, I had to stop doing poetry shows because I had too much good consensual sex. And I just wasn't resonating with other poets.
So most of the scene right now, you're trying to rebel against some of the things that are in the scene itself.
Because people are more than their trauma.
Right.
And people need to come out of their trauma and start embracing their healing and embracing their joy. And in so much, especially in like the slam and open mic venues, it's really embracing the trauma and the hurt and rejecting any growth and any joy. And I haven't seen that part embraced. And I would really like to see more of it, because I think the more we encourage people to value their trauma, the more we encourage people to stay in their trauma and never heal.
And this is from a person who did political psychology in school, so grad school. So it's kind of interesting how you basically you see the sadness and the pain and stuff, but you've also studied that in grad school. Mm-hmm. So, and also psychology too, as I've seen. Mm-hmm. UC Davis.
Yeah.
Aggies. Speaking of that, so since you have experienced that side of it, what does, Let's do like a weird U-turn, because you used to work in the political scene and stuff, and work in the industry.
It's an industry.
The government is an industry also.
Yes.
And you did all that, and then that one hopeful moment came up, and you did what?
I don't know if it was a hopeful moment. I did quit. I quit rather dramatically. Mm. And I was the head of a state agency here in California. And the board I was working with, I knew the direction they were going to take. It was a direction I radically disagreed with. Right. It was a direction that the Speaker of the Assembly had said, if you take this, we'll shut off all your funding, because that's why we shut you down in the first place.
Ouch.
And the board still took the vote to go back to the direction they were. And so after they took the vote, I quit, because I couldn't continue just to rubber stamp the Women's Legislative Caucus, which is what they wanted me to do. And I refused to do that because I didn't agree with the full agenda. And it also coincided at a time that I was getting more and more physically disabled. So I had to figure out, I was too physically ill to go back to the 9-to-5. And so I had to figure out what I could do to continue to create, to continue to contribute, and still not be able to go into a day job. And so I've always written, I've always researched, so I continued in that vein. And that's what transitioned me over to writing for a more general public. And so I had to really radically restructure my writing. The first two erotic novels I wrote, I had to fight the need to footnote it, because no erotic novel needs a footnote.
Explain that footnote.
So, like, I would reference something, I would reference a book or a concept, and then I'd realize that most readers aren't going to notice or understand what the reference was. So then there was, like, this desire to kind of footnote what it was and explain at the bottom.
So,
I had to break that, and I had to change my vocabulary and everything to reach a wider audience.
So is that the reason why the book Love Letters to a Unicorn was florist out of?
That I started writing a whole bunch of essays and stuff, and it's about 6 months before the 50 Shades of Grey movie came out, the first one. And the book had come out, it had been this radical success. It's a horrible book. As an author, just not even on the BDSM side, as an author, I'm offended that this got published and tractioned, because it is so poorly written.
True.
And, I mean, not even getting into the plot and the stereotypes and stuff that flourish in the book, just the language itself is, it's a badly written book. She's a horrible author.
True, but, you know, it's
just it did allow people to tap into, ooh, maybe I'm not the only one who likes, you know, sucking on toes or getting tied up or whatever.
So, being that you've now opened that door, you're into kink.
I am, and that's mostly what I write about now.
So, the kink community, you are a writer or a blogger.
I am.
In the kink community. And speaking about your blog, the blog is also the same name as your book, first book.
It started out as a book promotion site, and then as I added additional essays to it, it kind of took off, and now it's an entity in and of itself.
And being that you are, as they call in the book, the top 100 sex blogging superhero, what does that mean for you?
So so there's a site out there, kinkly.com, and they rank sex blogs and everything, and they're a site for all things, like for sex positive, sex education. And but they do rank their bloggers. In the last 2 years, I've been ranked in the top 100 bloggers. And they rank it on a series of different things. Part of it's the amount of traffic you get and the number of people who refer to you. Mm. Part of it is the quality of the blog and what you contribute. Part of it is the uniqueness. Every year in October, people are asked to vote for favorite sex blogs. So the last 2 years, I've ended up in the top 100 blogs.
Nice.
Sex blogs.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
And then from there, you've also done some other things in the kink community, or
I have.
What I say in other industries. You've also been a director.
I have directed my own and written my own porn. Whoa. And that was quite fun.
Oh.
And again, for me, there wasn't enough humor in porn. Like, porn is all serious. I mean, German and Japanese porn is probably the worst, because they just sound angry and weird.
Very rapey.
It's upsetting. Like, they're all so serious about it. And sex to me isn't serious. Mm. Like, it can be, and it can be, you know, very loving and connected. Most of the time, it's fun. Some of the time, it's ridiculous. And, you know, if you're not laughing, you're probably doing some of it wrong. So I hadn't found porn that, you know, except in a very small number of venues, that really resonated with me.
I could see that.
And so I wanted to produce humor porn.
Humor porn.
Yes.
So beyond the Benny Hill type porn.
Right. But I mean, where it's sexy, where people are actually having really sexy sex.
Right.
But there's still humor to it. Like that, you know, that to me is fun. That to me is how most people have sex, is we laugh during part of it.
Yeah. That is true. We do have, there is some corniness in sex that people try to fight. Just like in poetry, they try to fight that. Say they want to be as serious and involved. I'm doing this as an animalistic moment of rage. And it's like, well, can I just basically stick my tongue out? And
well, and if you look at what you do in bed with somebody, like just the random shit that people say in bed is funny.
That's true. That is true.
I mean, people, as I call it, it's temporary Tourette syndrome. Like, you burst out with random things you'd never say otherwise.
You know, you riding that cowboy. What else could you say? Yee-haw, old silver. What else? Why would you not?
If it sounds like flip-flops running down the hall and reminds you of your kids, like, all of a sudden it's going to get weird. Like, and you're going to say something. People fart during sex. Like, I mean, there's all these things that happen. And that's what I mean. They resonate with you.
Oh, man.
You know, you say weird stuff. You get in awkward positions. You accidentally kick somebody in the head when you're rolling over. Like, I mean, things happen. So why not?
Wow.
Why not embrace who most of us are? Okay. Most of us aren't getting in these weird angles just for the camera when we're doing it.
Touche.
Right?
Touche.
Most of us don't sleep with somebody who's wearing Tim's and sunglasses like that. Not a regular thing.
You know, the funniest thing, I never thought about it, but you're right. It's always weird how the I hate saying this word, people of color
mm-hmm.
are always put into a type of whatever simplistic or stereotypical mm-hmm. look, so people can get that. Some people feel like that's what they want, or that's right. the idea. They think that's what that person would be. Mm-hmm. He'd be a gangster holding a gun out and having it in his trousers as he's having sex, or
yeah.
have Tim's on, or even someone would have their head all wrapped up. If they're, it's like, really? Just like, don't see that any other way. Just see that. That's, I'm like, mm-hmm. oh, That's their weird ass idea of comedy, or is that just weird? Right. Their weird idea of stereotypes and stuff.
Well, and stereotypes. I mean, porn is one of the last big bastions of racism, where it's still okay. Like, if you're white and young, you have to be young, thin, bendy. You know, you may have a few tattoos, but you can't be fat. If you're white and fat, you still got to be under 40, but you can't be tattooed. Like, you can't violate multiple beauty standards.
Mm-hmm.
If you're black, you've got to be hung and thuggish. And you know, black women don't get nearly the traction in porn that white women do. Asian women get a lot more traction for views. If you're Asian, you have to be, you know, thin and demure and sleek. And mainstream porn is really racist.
Hmm.
So in the porn that I've shot, I've really tried to fight against it,
okay.
right? And find people who don't fit the stereotypical image of beauty, or pair a black woman with a white guy for interracial porn, because it's usually a black guy with a white woman. So let's flip that. Let's do interracial where there's no white people. Let's have a fat guy and a fat girl going at it. Like, it's not just a BBW, it's a BBC, you know, and they're like, you know, and they have a sandwich when they're done. Like, let's embrace the reality of sex for us.
So speaking of that, let's transition. Is that the reason why Fat Chicks on Top is what it is?
Fat Chicks on Top came out of a need to address a gap in the body positive podcast. Most body positive podcasts are like, hey, yeah, we'll embrace who we are as long as you're not super fat. We're not going to address racism as part of a body positive issue. We're not going to address colonialism as part of body positive. And people didn't want to have these conversations. Most body positive podcasts are really focused on not being political. And I don't see how your body can't be political. Our bodies are regulated by the government. What we can do, what we can put in them, what we can get in terms of medical treatment. A lot of that is very regulated and very policed. And even if it's not a formal law, there's still a lot of policing. You see the latest thing with Lizzo. A bunch of people say, well, the only reason Lizzo is popular is because, you know, we have this, you know, obesity epidemic in America.
Oh, it's like a Me Too movement.
Well, and they want to dismiss the fact that she has an amazing amount of talent. She has music that resonates with people. I mean, where else are you going to get a chick that is a concert flautist who also raps as well as she does? She is really an impressive talent.
She's been in the game for a long time.
She's been working it. And people, oh, no, it's just because you're fat. And it's like, there's a lot of pushback to the way you present yourself in public and trying to shut down fat women, especially fat women of color. You saw it with Gabori Sidibe, right. And people were coming after her, and she's like, yeah, I'm just crying on my private jet as I go to Cannes this year, which I love her for that.
Speaking of which, they're, I have seen that they have approved on the natural hair.
Yes.
Basically, now that you can now wear that in work instead of...
Right. And that's another form of body policing is Black women have... Their hair has been regulated, and until very recently, even in the military, you couldn't wear a natural hairdo. They were fine with braids, which take hours, or they were fine if you had it straightened. Again, you have to have a salon. This is not easy to do, and it's expensive. But natural hair was not considered professional, which is ridiculous. So Holly Mitchell, who is out of she's a senator out of Southern California, has been pushing this for a while and got a bill through that allows women to wear their natural hair at work and be considered professional, which, you know, we've needed for a very long time.
I can get that. But is that mostly is so the way it sounds like Fat Chicks on Tops, even though the name has a little bit of a tongue-to-cheek mm-hmm. moment.
It is.
It is. It seems it does have some political mm-hmm. values or events it regulates on and stuff.
We talk about the serious stuff, but I also bring on people to have lighter moments. Because, again, you can't be all serious and this is so hard to be a woman, it's so hard to be fat, whatever. That gets to be a real downer.
Yes. I see you have brought on comedians and also poets.
We bring on comedians, we bring on poets, we bring on entertainers, and we bring on porn stars, we bring on kink people, because all of our bodies mean something to us. It's how we mediate ourselves with the world. So, you know, I want people to talk about it and talk about the serious stuff. And we have some episodes coming up about people who live with type 1 and type 2 diabetes and what that is like and how they've dealt with it, because that's a very serious health concern. But there's also a lot of lightness in that because, you know, some of it's just you got to have fun.
And just to let people know, most of them are not fat, so or not considered overweight.
It depends on how you categorize. People worry about coming on the show and they're like, well, I don't think I'm fat. I'm like, you don't have to be fat on the show. Like, you can, all of our bodies somehow mediate how we move through the world. I don't think anybody is born being 100% comfortable in their body.
Right.
Like, they're like, woohoo, I'm everything I want to be, and I've always been that way.
Right.
Like, that's just not who we are as a species.
Yes.
But being able to talk about it and see where we connect and where we don't connect and understanding how other people's bodies change how they move through the world, I think helps understand and make connections with people.
Okay.
Because there's a lot of, like, you know, I grew up white in Southeast Idaho. I didn't see my first Black person until I was in fourth grade.
And what happened to that effect?
I was one of those horrible white women that went up and touched their hair, and that chick wanted to beat my ass, and it was completely legit.
White people, that's a no-no. Indian people, that's a no-no. Do not touch a Black person's hair without consent.
Exactly. But I had never learned that. I didn't know that. And, you know, so I started learning real fast. But I think, you know, we start to have these conversations and it's like, okay, so this is my experience. What was your experience of that?
Right.
Because you probably became much more aware of race and how that impacted how you moved through the world before I did.
I say it was in the earlier teenage years, but
right.
I've also learned about other things too, that there are people in life that go beyond just the race of factor. Mm-hmm. There's also a finance factor, a economy, and even social factor of it all.
Mm-hmm.
There's other things. Even with my mom and my dad divorcing, there's some other stuff that goes along with that.
Yeah, a lot of it comes with, and you know, people often don't see the disabilities that others live with, whether it be dyslexia or you know, heart issues or chronic pain, things that we don't necessarily see as disability because it's not visualized, but you have different interactions, mental illness, right? Different interactions, different conceptions of people. For most of my life, people would say, oh, you're one of the most stable people I know. And for me, that was a huge joke because I'm bipolar. I'm like, you're saying that and I'm seeing some shit over there in the corner that I know is not really there, but I'm the most stable person in your life. Good for you.
And since you point that out, you do have also disabled speakers and also mm-hmm. guests, or and also people who also have some illnesses and stuff. Mm-hmm. So you don't really just stick with, you know, physical part. You still do mental and all other things in your show.
Because it's all connected. It's back to the old Mr. Rogers song. Everything grows together because we're all one piece. Hmm. Your head grows as your fingers grows as your toes grow, right? And we're all connected. And
yeah, that makes sense. You know, everything grows together. And
right. But you can't address mental health without addressing physical health.
Right.
Right. Huge number of people live with depression.
Right.
A lot of depression is due to lack of adequate serotonin in the brain. However, 80% of the serotonin in the body is produced in the gut.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a leaky gut, if you have GI problems, if you have GERD, all of that can affect your level of serotonin, and that has nothing to do with your brain. And they found a lot of like the SSRIs and such, when you take them, strip your gut of the serotonin. So even though you're trying to boost it in your brain, you're actually draining yourself of it.
Hmm. So speaking of which, since you're talking about the GI tract and stuff, you also are a cook.
I am.
And you wrote a cookbook.
I did.
What made you write a cookbook?
I got tired of people asking me for recipes and having to rewrite them.
Okay.
No, seriously. People go, oh, I want that recipe. I want that recipe. I got sick of rewriting them. So it's like, just send you my cookbook now.
Since you are a cook and have a cookbook, will you be bringing any delectables?
Yes.
For the show?
Yes, I'll be bringing right. some yummies.
Oh, some yummies are coming, people, so be there for the show for that.
Should put in the clip of Marvin talking about my lemon cookies, because I think I'll bring those.
Oh, okay, we'll put that in. Insert.
Insert Marvin going, holy shit. I'm Asian and I like these.
We've got a lot of what do they call them? Clips.
We
people
do.
People giving sound clips. There you go. Sound clips of people giving you shout outs about your cooking.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of them Asian, which I thought that was funny. But yeah.
He was mad. He didn't like sweets until I made that. Now he just wants my cookies. He still asks about them.
He does, doesn't he?
It's been a year he's asking about them.
You got to oblige him coming.
I do. I do.
Boy needs. He needs it for where he's going. So it's all right. But anyway, but speaking of that, that was your third book that you've written, mm-hmm. whereas your second book was on submissives as a workbook.
Right.
So on that account, you basically got three books out for
under my name.
Under your name, Antivice, or your real name?
My real name.
Yeah, okay. And we're not going to get that out right now to people because you don't need to know it. But speaking of the podcast, you've been doing the podcast right now for almost, what, 2 years?
A year and a half, yeah.
A year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And have you enjoyed your podcasting?
I
or do.
Do
you enjoy being a guest on a podcast?
Both.
Both, okay.
Yeah, I'll talk to anybody.
Talk to anybody. Okay.
I'm a verbal slut.
Touche. Touche. So, what do we expect from you during your reading, since you are coming out?
I will probably do...
You don't tell us what you're going to do. Just give us a little bit of a hint.
A hint. There'll be a little bit of storytelling.
Okay.
There may be a little bit of essay reading.
Okay.
And, yeah, I haven't chosen all the pieces yet. I'm still working on it.
Okay. You have time.
Yeah, I have time.
January 6th.
So, yeah, I'll pull some stuff together from the different genres that I've worked in.
Okay. Well, you know what? I think we should leave off that. Thank you for being on the show. It was great that you were here. Why don't you tell the people out there where they can find your work and you?
So you can find me on all social media under Auntie Vice. It's Facebook, Twitter, IG, Reddit, I'm all over. You can find my books under my name, Rebecca Blanton, on Amazon and Google Play, at Barnes & Noble, at a few select independent bookstores. You can find the hard copies. You can find Fat Chicks on Top on most podcast streaming services. My website is loveletterstoaunicorn.com, which is my kink blog, and you can connect to me there as well. So hopefully you will come and find me. I will be at the Sacramento Poetry Center on January 6th. And I'm also at Submission Comedy at the Armory Cafe in San Francisco on Valentine's Day this year. Whoa. Doing a demo for how to take your partner home and have some kinky fun on Valentine's Day.
Yeah, you got to remember that, folks. Kinky fun. Come out if you can to San Francisco.
7 p.m.
7 p.m. And yes, you can also come see, you can also go to Iambic, go to Rest Wonderland, reswonderland.com/Iambic to find information about later events and shows and also about this podcast. And also you can find me, Sharon E. Smith, on Facebook. You can find me also on Iambic.
And a Serious Production.
And Serious Production. If you need some DJing, audio, and podcast services. And also you can see me on, if you're on Instagram, you can find me on as Rest Wonder or Serious Production. Serious Production is on Twitter and also on Instagram as a Serious Production. Yes, the whole word, a Serious Production.
You need to get your branding together.
I do need to get my brand. Well, I'm an individual. I have two sides of my branding. I let that know. But Rest Wonder on Instagram, Sharon E. Smith on Twitter, Sharon E. Smith on Facebook. Find me. You know who we are. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And our Auntie Vice and come to the show on January 6th. We will have some food. We'll have music. We'll have poetry that you never heard before. Shout out to Rebecca Blanton, Miss Auntie Vice, and Jorge Quintana for being here and being our features. We hope to see y'all soon. Later to the next show.